Good morning, and welcome to Faith Talks, the second half of what we've been doing for the month of June. Hopefully you had a nice 4th of July break, and that you've recouped some energies, which I managed to do over the 4th of July, and hope you're able to do that also. All right, you guys want to hear a joke this morning?
Yes.
Yeah? All right, are you on your toes?
Yes.
All right, this is a quickie. You can't blink and you'll miss it. I know. I can't fix it. All right. Okay, here's the joke. You ready? All right, a pastor went to church with a Band-Aid on his chin. And he stood up before the congregation to preach, and he wanted to take care of that. So he said, "I'm sorry for this bandage on my chin. I was thinking about my sermon this morning, and I cut my chin." And a quick-witted parishioner called out, "Well, how about next Sunday if you think about your chin and cut your sermon?" I thought that was quick-witted. You guys, did you like that one? All right, you're awake. That sounds good. All right, welcome to the Faith Talks sessions. We're on Session 5, Value 4. Now, remember last week I taught you a gospel presentation that you can say. All right, everybody stand up. Remember the gospel presentation we learned the last time? We're going to do that again. This is called the gospel in 10 seconds. If you're new, don't be intimidated. You'll learn it very quickly. Watch what Dr. J does, and then we'll do it together. All right, this presentation goes like this. God set it up, we upset it, Jesus reset it, and now we accept it or reject it. Everybody got it? It's real simple. Watch how it works. All right, here we go. God set it up, we upset it, Jesus reset it, and now we accept it or reject it. All right, that's great. Let's try it again one more time. All right, here we go. God set it up, we upset it, Jesus reset it, and now we accept it or reject it. All right, you did great. Thank you. That's a simple way to present the gospel in contemporary culture language. Goes like this. God set it up, we upset it, Jesus reset it, and then we accept it or reject it. Now, these cover these four themes that all play into the gospel, and just using that 10-second presentation of the gospel, you can introduce people to what it means to be a Christian. And then, of course, you'll need to explain it a little bit, but at least it will get you to where you need to go. Now, skill development questions. I'm going to let you at your tables answer this question for just a minute. Who is, to introduce our theme for today, who is the most persuasive person you know, and what makes them persuasive? What makes them so persuasive? So I want you to think about that for a second and talk at your tables. And after you've discussed it for a few minutes, we'll springboard into our presentation for today. All right, we're going to talk this morning about persuasion. So you obviously know people in your life that have a higher degree of persuasion than others. And so we want to inject that into our conversation and our understanding as we work through our faith talks. Now, let's go back to the scripture passage that we're basing all that we're talking about on for this training. I want to read this passage for the benefit of those that will be listening to it on audio. The passage is found in the New Testament, Colossians 4. It's in an obscure passage, in an obscure chapter in the New Testament. We tend to skip over the fourth chapter of Colossians, not as exciting as the rest of the book. But in this first half of Colossians 4, you've got some profound insight about how to reach out into the culture. Colossians 4, verses 2 through 6 says, "Devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open to us a door for the Word, so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I have also been imprisoned, that I may make it clear in the way that I ought to speak. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity, and let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person." Great passage, and let's work from this. All right, what we're doing from that passage is we have six core values that we're trying to work into our way of thinking in terms of how to advance the gospel with people outside the church and or outside Christianity and the faith. And there are six core values. We've covered these first three. And the first value is we are not called to bring everyone we know to Jesus, but we are called to bring Jesus to everyone we know. Value number two, we aim to fully understand both the gospel and the people we talk to before trying to introduce them to the gospel. And then principle or core value number three, we recognize the need to expand beyond gospel presentations to gospel conversations. So we had a spirited discussion about that last time we met 2 weeks ago. And now we're to value number four, which is the second half of the six. And that is this, we fully embrace the power of gentle persuasion. In our efforts to reach those that are outside the faith, we fully embrace the power of gentle persuasion. Now, let me tell you a story of what happened to me recently, and we'll let you guys react to this, and then I'll comment on it before I finish today. I recently attended a denominational meeting here in Atlanta, and the denomination that I'm ordained in, and they have two major worship services that are attended by hundreds of people. And so I was in this one particular worship service, and we had to scrunch together because there wasn't enough seating, so you had to sit by people that you didn't know. So I'm scrunched up next to this group of people, and I'm sitting next to a lady, and we sing a hymn like, "Holy, Holy, Holy," and we finish. And when we finished, she turned to me and she said, "I just feel the need to ask you this. Do you know Jesus?" Now, I want you to react to that experience. If you had been in that setting and in that situation, somebody asked you that question, how do you think you would react it? Talk to your tables in a minute. Talk to your tables. How do you think you would have responded? Okay. Now, let me tell you, now that you've had a chance to react to this idea, let me tell you what my reaction was. Sorry, that's the only way to get your attention. Well, anyway, my initial reaction was that of God? Is the Holy Spirit trying to tell me something? Do I need to get saved here? What was that about? Then my next reaction was, well, at least she's doing what I'm trying to get people to do, so I can't really criticize that. But then my third reaction was one of feeling violated. And the reason I say that is she didn't ask my name. She didn't say anything to me after I said that. It was like she just dropped a gospel grenade on me, a total stranger. And I just felt this discomfort. And I thought about saying something to her. And then I didn't want to do that because I wanted to process my reaction first. And of course, we then went into the Lord's Prayer and sang another hymn and a sermon in the middle of this context with a bunch of pastors and trying to figure out how to react to this whole thing. And as time went on, a couple of days later, I thought there was something not right about that. And I appreciate the zeal, but there was just something that I just not comfortable. Now, let's come back to this as we talk through this today. And what I want to talk to you about today is the power of persuasion. And let me give you some verses that emphasize this and that stress this from a biblical standpoint, and then we'll come back to this example and some others. Now, here are some verses that are found in the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is, of course, the book of wisdom. And this is what it says about persuasion. It says, "The wise of heart is called discerning, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness." Another verse, the wise in heart, Proverbs 16:23. "The wise in heart will be called discerning and adds persuasiveness or persuasion to his lips." Proverbs 16:24. "Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body." Now you see a repetition of ideas here of a sweet type of speech that increases or dramatizes the persuasion element in our speech with people. So there's some value to these verses. Now, here's a couple more verses. In Ephesians 4:29, it says, "Let no corrupting speech or talk come out of your mouths, but only such a word is for good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. Now, this is a marvelous verse that refers to boundaring your lips so that what you say doesn't have a corrupting, damaging, or violating effect upon others. But rather, it says to speak those things that are good for building up, and they're suitable to the occasion and the setting that you're in, and that it actually gives grace to those who hear. So you can be an instrument of the grace of God just by what you say and how you say it. And certainly, not only is this true to Christians, but it's also true to non-Christians. And that's what the passage we read from Colossians 4 says to do. Let your speech always be with grace. And then Proverbs 3:3-4 says, do not let kindness and truth leave you. Bind them upon your neck, write them upon the tablet of your heart, so you'll find favor and good reputation in the sight of God and men. Now, this verse gives us two rails that the train of speech or conversation should run upon. Kindness, sensitivity to people, and truthfulness. Let's be faithful to reality, but also let's be sensitive to people. And if we are discerning as far as these goes, it says we'll find favor and good reputation in the eyes of God and people. So there's some profound things here that we should give some thought to in terms of how we interact with others, and understanding that persuasion is what we need to be thinking about today, because in today's culture, anything that feels confrontational or impositional, they're going to shut down on. It doesn't really matter what it is. Anything that's confrontational or impositional, people will back away from that, hence the importance of persuasion. So, here's a suggestion I want to make to you, and this might rock your world a little bit, but it's one I want you to think about. And that is, within the church today, we tend to pride ourselves and to seek after boldness. seek after boldness. But what we see as boldness, as Christian insiders, the world often sees as boorishness. And what I mean by that is we tend to think of a bold person as somebody who doesn't hold back and speaks forth the gospel and gets it into the conversation. And when we do that, sometimes we feel very good about ourselves that we took the risk and we got the gospel out, or we spoke about God in a setting where we're not sure what the reaction was going to be. We tend to feel good about that. But oftentimes what passes for boldness within the body of Christ is perceived as boorishness outside the body of Christ. So how you interpret your actions, or how we interpret our actions as Christians versus how the world interprets them, is often two very different things, and we've really missed this point badly. And we've messed up some conversations because of it.
Are you saying that they give truth without grace?
Well, let's keep talking. Follow me as we go through this, and this should become clear to you. Now, let me ask you to do this. Whenever we deliver a verbal message to people around us, there are three aspects of that verbal message. The first one is body language. The second one is the spoken words. And the third one is the tone of voice. Now, what I want you to do is these three numbers you see up here, 7, 38, 55, they are percentages of these messages. Someone has studied this closely. Now, what percentage would you ascribe of 7, 38, and 55 to those three aspects of a verbal communication? What would be your guess? In other words, what aspect of the message is 7%? What aspect of the message? What aspect of the message is body language? And what aspect of the message is tone of voice? Now, you make your play, and then I'll tell you what the survey said. Now, the instinctive reaction is that the words you speak are the majority of the message. That's the instinctive reaction, right? Okay. Well, here's what those who studied this found out. The breakdown looks like this, that 55% of what you say to people, over half of it has to do with your body language, which is why emails today and text and Twitter and all that jazz, you don't get the benefit of that, so it's easy to misinterpret those messages. 38% is your tone of voice. If you think about that, you can say, how are you today, in a very nice, loving voice. Or you can say, how are you today, in a very irritated voice. And you send a message either way. And then they found that only 7% are the actual words that are spoken. Now, notice how your body language and your tone of voice send a clear message to people. And that's what I mean when I say that sometimes we kind of relish the idea of boldness, but we're sending a message to people that is not often taken the way we intend for it to be taken, so we need to give some thought to this. Now, let me give you another insight that I've found incredibly valuable when it comes to interacting with outsiders or people that are outside the faith. This little bullseye thing up here represents layers of human personality. Okay? The outside layer is what we call the public self. The middle layer is what's called the personal self. And then the third inner core is called your private self. Now, public information, or that outer yellow circle, would be something like where you work or where you live. In other words, that's information about you that's out in the public domain, and everyone can access that without any sense of violation or penalty. The third level is your personal world, and that would be something like how many bedrooms are in your house, or is your house a two-story or a one-story? That's kind of personal information. And then thirdly, private information would be how much you paid for the house. That's your own private information. You don't talk about that. Another illustration of this would be where you have a job. Let's suppose you work at Citicorp. That's public information. how much you make an hour or what your salary is, that's personal information. That's not open to the public. In your private world would be how much is your job adding to your net worth? Your net worth is private information. Now, you can use this little layered view of human personality, and you can work with this in a number of different ways. in a physical sense, it's true about our bodies. There's public, there's personal, and then there's private. And so you can work with this thing. Now, here's the mega question for us today. For Christians, our faith is public, personal, or private? For Christians, your faith tends to be public information. Do you withhold that from people? No, you tell them. You tell them that you're a person of faith. So that tends to be something you put out in front of others without any sense of shame. Now, reverse the question to the non-Christian. Non-Christians, where they are in their relationship with God, is that public, personal, or private? It's very private. Now, what you and I talk about, our faith in a public setting, which is very natural and easy for us, that's public information and we don't mind talking about it. But when it comes to the average outsider or lost person, where they are in their journey is a matter of their private world. And what we're able to interact with others very naturally and easily around where we are in our faith, the opposite is true for lost people. They don't interact so easily and so readily about where they are in their faith journey. In fact, to them, that's very private information. So here's what happens, is that when we Christians who are very public about our faith try to get into a direct conversation with a lost person about where they are in their spiritual journey, we are crossing at least two boundaries when we do that. And we're not supposed to cross personal boundaries without permission to do so. And so, again, we're taught and we've been encouraged to be bold with our faith and to get it out there as quickly and as easily and as readily as we can. And what we don't often realize is that in private conversations, when you do that too aggressively and too quickly, you are crossing boundaries. And you're entering into people's private world in a way that they find, regardless of what you and I think about it, they find it offensive and violating. So let's work with this for just a minute. When I was a child, I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I'll illustrate this point in my life about crossing boundaries. When I was a kid, there were some neighbors across the street that had a number of kids our ages, and we interacted every day, especially in summers like this. And we'd go into each other's houses very easily and readily and not think anything about it. And I used to walk across the street and walk into their house, even when the door was closed, without knocking on the door. I'd just walk in because we interacted like that. That's just sort of how we did it. And one day they were sitting at the dinner table, and I opened the door and walked in, and I heard another family member say to the other family member, "See?" And I didn't know what they were talking about. A year later when I realized that when that person said, "See," to the other person at the table, they were saying, "See what he's doing? He just walks in without knocking." And I didn't realize that as a kid. And years later when I started to understand boundaries, that started to make sense. So here I was assuming access to those people's homes that I really didn't have the right to assume that I had. And as I look back at it now, it was just one of those kid mistakes you make, but it was still a violation of a boundary. You know, I want you to kind of see that. Now, good conversationalists, remember what we're emphasizing in this training, is that good conversationalists are people that know how to navigate people's boundaries without violating them. And let's talk about this. First of all, good conversationalists discern and respect personal boundaries. We understand the concept of boundaries, and we respect those boundaries. And good conversationalists know how to interact with people and respect their boundaries without making them feel violated. Number two, good conversationalists cross boundaries through the gates that people open when they feel safe with someone. Now, what we tend to do is allow people access into our private and personal worlds once we feel safe with people, right? And we don't drop those boundaries, but we open the gate and we let certain people in. Not everybody's allowed in, but certain people we trust and feel safe with are allowed in. So good conversationalists recognize that you have to win the trust of people before you go past their boundaries, and you only cross their boundaries when they allow you to do so. Principle number three, the polite way to cross boundaries is to ask permission before you do it. And when I learned this in evangelism, I can't tell you the stress factor that it took out of my conversations with people when I just stopped and took the time to ask. May I ask you this question? And I have a relationship in my life right now that I can't go into much detail about it. If I could tell you the story, I would. And it's with a person who lost a child to suicide years ago, and it had an incredibly traumatizing effect upon this person. And it's still going on in this person's life, and I'm trying to figure out how to find out where they are in their spiritual journey without just boring into that, because there's probably some deep anger and disappointment toward God inside of this person that their child, who was 10 years old when he took his life. This is a brutal thing. I mean, none of us would process this easily. So I'm running out of time because this person's not going to be in my life forever. And so what I'm going to do, hopefully this next week, if I get a chance, and I've got a limited window, is just ask permission by saying, you know, when all the times we've been talking, we really haven't gotten into spiritual things much, but are you comfortable talking about where you are in your spiritual journey? And the chances are this person's going to say no. I think there's a good chance this person's going to say no. But I need to ask that question before I assume I can just start talking about this. Or I could stir up a lot of trauma inside of this person and get a very intense reaction. So that's just an example of what I mean by asking permission. So rather than thinking, okay, I'm only going to talk to this person a couple more times, I got to get the gospel in here, or God's going to hold me accountable, feeling all that unhealthy pressure, which is a good pressure sometimes, other times not so good. I need to make sure that I don't cross boundaries here and hit a nerve inside this person that might traumatize them or stir up that trauma. And of course, they know that I'm a pastor. And when a pastor crosses boundaries, and I've done that before, it's a whole lot worse than when you cross them. Because pastors are supposed to be sensitive people. And I've made that mistake of doing that. Now, people, here's what you want to understand, is that people do want to talk. And they want to talk a lot of times about the spiritual journey. But they want to talk on their terms. And their terms are things like timing, when do we talk about it, and to what degree do we talk about it. And so when we barge into people's lives and kind of hit them with the gospel and we get a resistant reaction, we assume they're close to the gospel. And I think that's a misjudgment. I find that most people are open to talking about where they are with God in their spiritual journey, but it's got to be on their terms. It's got to be when they're ready, in their timing. And this requires discernment and sensitivity. All right, well, having said that, now let me go back to an acrostic that I presented to the congregation a couple years ago in a sermon that I did. And let me just call your attention to this, and then we're going to move into the heart of what we're talking about today. And this little acrostic is the word serve. It's built around five letters, the five-letter word serve. And what I'm hoping to instill inside of insiders as Christians, that toward outsiders who are lost, we need to take a position of how can we serve them? How can we be a blessing to the people we're trying to reach? Rather than how can I get them saved, get them into church, get them singing in the choir after they join the church. Instead of that pressure, let's look at not how we're trying to get people into our churches so that our churches grow. And I know that that's it's a good thing to get people into churches. I'm just saying that can't be a blunt motivation. But these simple concepts here I've found have revolutionized the way I relate to people. And generally when I do these things, folks don't have any problem lowering their boundaries and letting me in to talk to them about spiritual things. And they go like this. Number one, when we get into conversation with people, see their hearts and not their layers. Lost people have things about them that bother us. Some are chain smokers. Some use crass language. Some tell off-color jokes. And those are things that can bother us, and we can be put off by them. But go below the surface and look not at the layers, but at their hearts. Look below the surface and don't be deceived by appearances. Number two, engage their hearts and not their lifestyles. Find out what's happening in their lives. How do they feel about their lives and their journey, and how are things going? And just kind of listen for what's happening in their lives versus feeling the need to challenge their lifestyles. And when we talk to people that are of a different lifestyle and they're making choices that inside of us we're saying, oh my goodness, I can't believe you're doing that to yourself. If you try to engage them on that level too soon, they're going to shut down on you. So the reason why people are making the choices they're making today is because they're looking for love and they look for it in the wrong places. We all have done that and will do that. And that requires a certain sympathy toward them. So engage their hearts and not their lifestyle. Number three, respond to their needs and hurts and not their beliefs. When you talk to somebody who's different than you are in terms of a Hindu or a Muslim, it's easy to get caught on an interaction level about their beliefs, but try not to go there too soon, but rather respond to what's happening in their lives, not so much what they believe. We had a couple across the street from us who just went through a really horrible divorce. They're both from India. And my wife discerned quite a while ago that the marriage was not going well. I never picked up on it. But it just blew up. And they sold the house across the street, and Cindy spent probably 3 weeks of her time helping the husband get the house ready for sale. And when we tried to talk to him about his Hindu beliefs, he was cynical and basically said, don't you try to tell me that Jesus is the only way to God, because I'm going to throw you out of my house if you basically say that. So we couldn't go there, but we were able to respond on a need level and help him prepare his house for sale. And the conversation hopefully will be ongoing. And he knows that we're serious about them as people. We care about them as people. And so keep that in mind. Number four, vulnerable identification versus shaming criticism. We can look at the decisions and the things that people are doing in their lives and easily shame them or make them feel ashamed of the dumb things they're doing. And some people do really dumb things, and we can't figure out why. And what we should do, on the other hand, as opposed to shaming them, we should try to identify with their brokenness and say, yeah, I've been there, done that before, and this is what happened when I did that. And I've made decisions like you've made before too, when this is how it blew up in my life, and I understand your pain. But being vulnerable as Christians is sometimes we resist because we think we have to present an image to the world that we've got it all together. And they know that's not true, and it's a facade to try to do that. Everybody knows that everybody has issues. We're just in a different place, in a different setting, and that by the grace of God, we have issues, but God is helping us, and He's forgiven us, where they don't have that grace and they don't have that forgiveness. That's the difference, but we've all got issues. So when and where you can identify with someone, if a non-Christian comes to you and says, I really struggle with anxiety, and you take anxiety medicine, why don't you tell them that? Why don't you say that to them? Yeah, I struggle with that too. And I have a relationship with God and He helps me with it. But tell them those things. If somebody you're talking to is really in a deep depression and you've struggled with depression, don't be afraid to disclose that. Let them know that. And then the fifth thing is empower other people's hearts by praying for them, not so much preaching to them. In other words, when somebody shares, I'm really struggling with heavy anxiety, I'm so paralyzed I can't get out of bed in the morning, we don't need to try to hurl the gospel at them necessarily, depending on where we are in the conversation, but we can say, how can I pray for you? What can I pray? Do you need to change doctors? Do you need to change medicine? How can I pray for you? Let me ask God to help you. And I find most people are open to that, and they will be very honest about what's happening in their lives, and they also feel your loving concern when you do that. So this little serve acrostic changes the way we relate to the people around us. And it gets us off our pedestals, out of our Pharisaism, and down on a human level where people are. And most people are willing to talk to another human being about their humanness when they don't feel judged or criticized, when they feel embraced and identified with. That's just how it works. So let's just keep this little serve acrostic in mind. Now, here's the heart of what we're going to talk about today. And I need for you to let this settle in and walk away with this as we leave today and think about this. Now, if we're going to be persuasive people who try to reach the lost, there are three D's of gentle persuasion that you want to lock into. And I mean, you want to lock into these and you want to understand these and you want to begin to inject these into your life in conversation with lost people whenever and however you can. And here they are, the three D's. Number one, the goal of our conversations with people that are not believers is to stir up doubt about their skepticism or about their lostness or about their adherence to a faith that we know is not going to take them or bring them into God's favor. So the goal is to stir up doubt within them about what they believe. Number two, we want to minimize their defensiveness. If we stir up defensiveness within the people we're trying to talk to, they are going to close down on you. So you want to do it in a way that minimizes their reaction to what you're saying. So you minimize defensiveness. And then number three, here's the corner we want to turn. As along with stirring up doubt about their skepticism and minimizing their defensiveness, we want to stimulate in them a desire for the truth. Stimulate within them a desire for the truth. You keep trying to keep this analogy in your mind. You're in a boat and you're in a sea where there's a bunch of lost people around you and they're in a boat. Okay, their boat is leaking and it's going to sink. It's a slow leak. They can't really tell it, but that boat's leaking. It's going to sink. And one day it's not going to keep them afloat in the water. Your boat, by the grace of God, has been sealed of all the leaks, and your boat is not going to sink. And what you're trying to do is to get them out of their boat that's sinking into your boat that's not sinking. And that's a very gentle process. You can't drag them out of their boat into your boat, but you can persuade them to leave their boat, which is a scary thing to do, and come into your boat. And you got to persuade them to do that. You can't force them to do it. You got to persuade them to do it. So the way we do that is, first of all, letting them know that their skepticism isn't working and that it's going to jeopardize their eternal security. Your boat is slowly leaking. You may not see that today, but it is happening. Number two, I'm here to help you, not to hurt you. And I'm not trying to sell you anything, but I'm trying to help you get to a place that's better than where you are. So please hear me. And then thirdly, create within them a persuasive desire. Persuade them to see that you've got something better than what they've got. It's called stirring up a desire for the truth. Now, let's take these ideas here, and let's look at how Jesus did this. All right, here we go. First of all, the goal is to stir up, the first D in our conversational efforts is to stir up doubt about one's skepticism. which means to truthfully point out the deficiencies and disadvantages of their skepticism, which leads to brokenness with God. In other words, point out the gaps in their thinking. Now, how did Jesus do this? Let's look at the example of Jesus. Well, we have a record of a handful of conversations that Jesus had with people who were not yet people of faith. And one of those was a guy named Nicodemus in John chapter 3. And the story reads like this. Now, there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. And this man came to Jesus by night and said to him, "Rabbi, we know that we've come from God as a teacher, for no one can do the signs that you do unless God is with him." And Jesus answered to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." Now, notice that Jesus was, by probably all standards here, fairly blunt with this person. He did not withhold the truth, but he told him the truth. And this guy came kind of beating around the bush about what a great teacher Jesus was. And Jesus knew why he came to see him, which is he wanted some affirmation from Jesus that in all of his religious Pharisaism, he was in a good place. And Jesus pushed all that aside and said to him, "Unless you're born again, you cannot see the kingdom of God." So Jesus pointed out a gap or a deficiency or a disadvantage in his way of thinking. This self-righteous moralism that you're involved in is not going to get you to heaven. And so Jesus pointed out doubt or created doubt in this person's mind. And he was one of the great religious leaders of his day. He was a ruler in Israel, which means he was probably one of the Sanhedrin, one of the top 70 most spiritual people in the whole nation of Israel at that point. And Jesus took the legs out from under him in terms of his self-righteousness and said, "No, there's a better way." So Jesus pointed out the hole or the gap in his thinking. Pointing out the gaps in their viewpoints creates doubt. Pointing out the gaps in people's viewpoints creates doubt. And that's what we're aiming to do. All right, the next principle is, along with stirring up doubt, is to minimize their defensiveness. So therefore, we should gracefully point out God's passionate love for them and for their good. And we need to make sure that the way we say what we say is couched in that sensitive language. Minimize offensiveness by gracefully pointing out that God's passionate love for the person you're talking to, and he's also out for their good. Now, where is this found an example with Jesus? Well, remember John chapter 8, there was a woman who was caught in the physical act of adultery. And the religious leaders of the day were looking for an opportunity to tempt Jesus. So they caught this woman in the physical act and drug her into the temple while he was teaching to a large group of people. And you can only imagine the horrendous discomfort that this represented, the humiliation to this woman. And they were using her to trap Jesus. I mean, they were devious in what they were doing. And so Jesus, they walk in and they say, "We caught this woman in the act of adultery. What do you say, Jesus? Should we stone her or not?" And so Jesus doesn't say anything. He just leans down on the ground and starts writing something in the ground, and we don't know what that was. And then he stands up and he says, "Okay, those of you without sin, get busy. Start stoning this woman." And it says that they all started to leave one by one. And notice this next phrase, it says, "Starting with the older ones, they started to walk out." Which should suggest to us that as time goes on in life, we become more and more aware of our brokenness. The more mature we are, we stop playing the game of being trying to look together. And it says they all left. And so Jesus turns to her and he says, "Is there no one here to condemn you?" And she said, "No, they're all gone." And then he says, "You really did a stupid thing. Don't ever do that again and humiliate yourself like this." Which is what a school principal said to me when I got caught cussing on the school grounds. The principal took me in, gave me 3 licks, and then said, "Don't do something stupid like this again," in a very judgmental way. And Jesus could have said that. She got caught in the physical act. But instead he said, "There's no one here to condemn you, then neither do I. Go your way now, and don't do this again." In a gentle, loving, accepting, gracious way. This is one of the clearest pictures of grace you find in the New Testament. And do you think she got the message? You think she was motivated to accept that challenge of of not doing this again, I think he won her heart pretty handily. So the second thing is, along with stirring up doubt, is minify defensiveness by being gracious toward people. And so communicating understanding to someone minimizes defensiveness. When we identify with someone's sinful choices and their weakness and their brokenness, when we identify with that and we show understanding to them, that minimizes offensiveness. Now, the third principle, which is to stimulate in them a desire for the truth. Truthfully point out the compelling advantages of belief and trust in God. Truthfully point out the compelling advantages of being a person of faith and putting your faith in Jesus. Now, where do we see this in the life of Jesus? In John chapter 4, we have the woman at the well in which Jesus was seated at a well, weary from a full day's journey. It was around the noon hour, hot as blazes. He's sitting in a well. A woman walks up. He gets into conversation with this woman. At first, she's put off, like, what are you doing talking to a woman, much less a Samaritan woman? And Jesus just pushed through that and kept talking. And he says to her, he said, give me a drink. And she says, okay. And she pulls up water. And then Jesus says to her, everyone who drinks of this earthly water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him shall never thirst. Woo. But the water that I give him will become a well, will become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life. Now that's a great statement. And this woman is intrigued by what he says, and she says, sir, give me this water. See, in other words, he created within her a desire for what he had. So I'll not be thirsty and I don't have to come to this well anymore. You can understand that. Walking all the way to the well and pulling that water. And so she says, yeah, give me this water. So notice how Jesus created in her a desire for something that was better than what she had. And so tying the needs of people to the benefits of the gospel is the way we create interest in the truth in people. When you tie the benefits of the gospel to the person's brokenness or neediness. And Jesus did that very wisely. So putting these three things together, here is the core element of persuasion. Number one, we want to point out or create doubt in people regarding what they believe, their skepticism. Number two, if you come on too strong, you create defensiveness. And people will defend what they believe because it's a part of their personalities if they're defending themselves. They will defend that as quickly as they'll defend their ethnicity because it's part of them. So secondly, minimize offensiveness. And then thirdly, create within them a desire for the truth. And this is where your personal experience firsthand of the gospel creates or has so much impact in the hearts and lives of people. I can take a quick question. Yeah.
You don't mean that we should say that to them.
No, you don't want to say that. That's overselling the gospel. You don't want to put words in God's mouth when you're hyping benefits to the gospel. Or if you come to the Lord, you'll get rich. Those are really destructive things to say. Thank you for pointing that out. All right, so now here's what I want to do with you the remaining time we've got. This little card on your table, everybody pick up this card that you see on your table. And let me talk to you just for a minute about how we can sort of gain permission to talk to people so that we cross through their boundaries and they tell us yes or no when it comes to whether they're ready to listen to us. Now, the standard questions that people have been asking in evangelism down through the years have been the two questions that the Coral Ridge Evangelism Program made famous, which was, number one, if you were to die today, are you sure you'd go to heaven? And the second question was, if you died today and stood before God and he said, why shall I let you into heaven, what would you say? Now, those two questions are the questions that we typically ask to diagnose where a person is. The problem with today is when you say, if you die today, you're sure you go to heaven, some people are going to look at you and say, I don't believe in heaven. So I don't care one way or the other. Or if you say, if you stand before God and he says, why shall I let you into heaven, they might say, I don't know and I don't care because I'm not even sure there's a God up there. And so my philosophy is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow I die, so I really don't care. Now, here's a different way to get at these questions with people and do it in a way that doesn't create this shutdown response. Now, on your little card, turn to the side that has the lines at the bottom. You want to get on that side of the card. Now, here are four questions that I ask people that I find this very helpful in opening conversational doors. And the first question is, if you look on the continuum, the first question is, you ask the person, would you say that your spiritual beliefs are specific or vague? Notice you didn't even bring God into the question, or heaven. You just said, are your spiritual beliefs specific or vague? And let them give you an answer. Then the next question you ask is the vertical line from top to bottom. You say, how confident or doubtful are you about what you believe? Now, if they say, I'm very doubtful about what I believe, then you've got a person who's at least not sure about what they believe. And if the specific, and also if they're vague and not specific and they're doubtful about what they believe, you're probably close to having an open door with somebody. Now, flip the card over. Flip the card over. On the back side of the card, you ask these two questions. How comfortable or uneasy are you about your beliefs? For instance, are you nervous about where you are, and are you wrestling with this right now and not sure? And depending on what they say, then you ask the last question, and that's the horizontal line question. Are you open or not open to talking about it? And if they say not open, don't push it. If they're not there, they're not there. And we need to respect that boundary. They've said no to you, so you don't push it. But if they say, yes, I'm open to talking about it, now what you've done is, in a very general way, you've found an open door. Whether the person is specific or vague about what they believe, whether they're confident or uneasy about what they believe, whether they are doubtful about what they believe, the main thing is you've asked the question, how open or not open are you to talking about it? And if they say not open, of course you've got your answer. If they say, no, I'm open, let's talk about it. Now you got your open door. And notice that you've asked permission, and they've given you permission to talk to them about it. And when we go out on the street and we do servant evangelism, we more or less use this card. And we find people that are specific or not, or vague or not, or comfortable or confident or not. But the main question is, are you open to talking about it? And if they're open to talking, then there's your door. And the person's given you permission to discuss it with them, and you've been allowed into their private spiritual world, and you can go from there. And that's where you have to think on your feet and get into conversations with people and guide where you're going. But here's essentially what you want to try to do. So I want to put this little tool in your hands that has these four questions in which you can more or less find out where a person is, and you can do so, again, without violating boundaries, but you can get into the conversations with them in which they either give you permission or they don't. And we have people all the time say things like, yeah, I'm kind of interested, but I don't want to talk about it now. Or if I ever do get interested, I'll remember this conversation. So they dictate all of these different things, and you have to go on their terms or you will violate the conversation. Now, we've gone way over time today, and this is the most intense. We've got this week and next week are the two most intense presentations, so we went along. But here's a summary of what we're trying to do. Value number four is we value persuasion. We aim for gentle, persuasive gospel conversations, notice, designed to win the person, not the argument. If you get into an argument with somebody who's lost, you might well win the argument, but you're probably going to lose the person. And you can't afford to do that. If they shut down on you, then you can't go any further. So the goal is to be gentle, persuasive, to introduce gentle, persuasive conversations that are designed to win the person, not the argument. In this verse, Proverbs 11:30 says, the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and he who is wise wins souls. The goal is not just to confront them. The goal is to win them. And here are some thoughts on the essence of how to be persuasive. And why don't y'all take just 3 or 4 minutes at your table. If there's any questions that you've got among yourselves, but y'all try to be through by 10:20 because you got to get to the worship service. And I'm sorry this was a little bit long, but we just had to cover it. Next week is another intense presentation, and then it'll even out from there. So have a little bit of fun at your tables for about 5 minutes, and then let's go home. Concept next week will be value number 5. We strive for purposeful conversations. And this next topic next week, if you can possibly get here, make sure you get here because this is the hinge upon which it all swings. All right, have a good time at your tables.